This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. On Wednesday, less than a week before Kobe Bryant's trial for felony sexual assault was to begin, Colorado District Court Terry Ruckriegel dismissed the charges at the request of the prosecutors. In a statement read by his attorney, Bryant apologized to the woman who brought the charges and to her family and said, quote, "Although I truly believe this encounter between us was consensual, I recognize now that she did not and does not view the incident the same way I did. I now understand how she feels and that she did not consent to the encounter." Mark Stein has been following the Kobe Bryant case for ESPN. He joins me now on the line. Mark, I gather the case was dismissed essentially because the woman who brought the charges against Kobe Bryant decided not to testify and because the judge felt the prosecution had no case.
Yeah, but, you know, I think if you followed it, and really, at least among NBA types, you know, we're not law mavens by any stretch, but, you know, there have been cracks in this case apparent really from the start. I mean, if you go all the way back to October, the original judge who bounded over trial publicly stated that the prosecution had a weak case. And I think we've only seen that case grow weaker and weaker. And once the accuser was unwilling to testify, the prosecution had no choice. And that apology you read, I think, has surprised some people. But basically, the way Kobe's people have described it is, if you had the opportunity to put your name on a document that basically says, we agree to disagree about what happened, and you could walk and have your freedom, anybody would do that. And I think that's why Kobe issued that apology.
It's interesting that you put it that way, we agreed to disagree, because it seems to me it could be interpreted that Kobe Bryant's statement concedes the plaintiff's point of view.
Well, no, because I think after they issued that statement, his lawyers continued to say, no, he's innocent. Kobe only wrote the statement in this way because it was a condition that the accuser insisted on as far as not going forward with the criminal trial. So the Bryant camp is definitely portraying this is just what we had to do for Kobe to secure his freedom. They're not conceding anything.
You mean what we had to do, but he doesn't really believe it?
Well, again, I think that agree to disagree is probably the best way to describe it. Kobe is saying, I don't think I did anything wrong. I understand that the accuser sees this event in a different light, but that's as far as he went.
Still an extraordinary statement coming from a man who's facing a $1 million civil case, isn't it?
Well, I think it has surprised legal experts, but I'm sure with Kobe, with the wealth that he has and the ability to pay a high sum, he'd do whatever he has to do for this thing to go away at this point.
In a piece that ran on ESPN.com on Thursday, you wrote that the Lakers and other teams that pursued Kobe Bryant when he became a free agent had, quote, strong indications that this case was going to be dismissed. Were there other indications that only people like NBA types knew about, or should we all have known this case was never going to go to court?
You know, I don't think you can ever be 100% certain when you're dealing with the court system. But, you know, especially in recent weeks, we've just gotten so many whispers that the accuser's resolve was weakening, that the various leaks that were coming out of Eagle County were just making her very reluctant to take the stand and testify against Kobe. And if she didn't testify, certainly there was no case. But I think from an NBA perspective, you know, we had the Jason Williams trial recently, and that was a case where there was just tons of evidence presented against Williams. He was found to have handled a gun in a shooting death of a limousine driver, was reported to have said, my life is over, and he avoided manslaughter charges in that case. In this case, which is a he said, she said, nobody in the NBA ever believed that Kobe was in real peril of going to jail. And that was proven on July 1 when he became a free agent and teams were lining up begging for Kobe to consider them. And you would think, wow, the Lakers gave this guy a $136 million contract. You know, they wouldn't have done that and traded Shaquille O'Neal and let Phil Jackson go if they didn't have strong confidence that they were going to have Kobe Bryant's services come October.
Is it fair to say that your conclusion is that wealthy pro athletes are likely to avoid convictions for serious crimes no matter what the circumstances?
The only reason I put them together, I mean, we're talking about two totally different types of incidents, but the reason I put them together just from an NBA perspective, you know, again, in the NBA, none of us can really claim to be law experts, but if you're working in the NBA, a player in the NBA, a team executive, if you just look at it, that the Jason Williams case, what seemed to be a really strong case against him, and he was able to avoid the most serious charges, this never looked like a strong case against Kobe Bryant from October when even that first judge was saying that the prosecution had a weak case, and it only got weaker and weaker as the months went on. That's why I just say that in the NBA there was never a sense that Kobe was in serious trouble here.
Do you feel it's fair to generalize beyond those cases to highly paid basketball players and athletes in general as far as their fate in the courts is concerned?
I know people like to. I don't know that I would do that. For me, following the NBA is a 24/7 kind of job, so I kind of keep a limited focus. So, again, that's why I link those two cases together, because to me, they're both NBA cases, but certainly there's a perception out there that people have that in any kind of celebrity trial that the money is always gonna win out in the end, the party that has the financial resources.
Mark Stein followed the Kobe Bryant trial for ESPN.com. Mark, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Anytime, Bill.
If you haven't been paying attention to NASCAR this season, you've missed a change or two. No longer sponsored by the makers of an addictive cancer-causing agent, the series is now supported by our latest addiction, cell phones. And in an effort to make the late season more exciting, the chase for the cup is now preceded by the chase for the chase for the cup. Lee Spencer is the guru of all things motorsports for the Sporting News, and she joins me from the press box at the California Speedway in Fontana. Lee, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sunday's race at Fontana is the second to the last event in the chase for the chase. Can you explain exactly what that means?
Well, we basically at this point now have a 26-race season, very similar to stick and ball, other than the numbers have been changed to protect the innocent. After that 26-race cutoff, the top 10 drivers will transfer to the chase. They will be the only drivers other than number 11, who is kind of like a wild card, or any drivers within 400 points of the total number of points that the champion ends up with. So those drivers are all eligible for the chase, and kind of like a playoff system where they're going to be running for the Nextel Cup.
Well, as I understand it, if we're looking for someone to blame or thank for these changes, we should look to last year's winner, Matt Kenseth, who made for a rather dull late season while he drove away with a championship with only one win and no poles. Is that right?
Well, shame on NASCAR for being in a situation where they're not rewarding consistency. They had rewarded consistency in the past, but, they found the whole situation milquetoast, and so they wanted to find some way to jazz it up. TV wanted to find some way to jazz it up. So as we roll into September, they wanted to find something that perhaps would give them a little bump in those, the final third of the season, and they came up with this chase format, and the guys who put up the most top fives, top sixes, top sevens are going to be the ones that are going to be fighting for the championship at Homestead in November.
Some of the usual suspects have been guaranteed a spot, Jeff Gordon, Jimmy Johnson, and Dale Earnhardt Jr., but who in the current top 10 is looking vulnerable?
Well, you have Mark Martin right now. He's 12th in points. He is 35 points outside of 10th. Ryan Newman is 26 points in on the other side. Then you have newcomer Casey Kane, who's just had a phenomenal rookie season. He's won 4 poles. He has 8 top fives. He's just 26 points behind Newman. And you're just looking at that, and if you had to say who in the top 15 or kind of surprises you that they haven't locked in, you'd have to mention, you mentioned Dale Jarrett, Mark Martin. Those would be the two guys that I'm like, if they don't make it to the chase, it's going to be a sad day come Sunday after Richmond.
I want to leave the championship talk for just a minute. Jimmy Johnson and Jeff Gordon have both been involved in controversy this season when they cunningly avoided being photographed in victory lane celebrations with NASCAR's sponsored drink, which competes with their team's sponsored drink. I may be being naive here, but aren't there bigger worries in the world and perhaps even in NASCAR than Coke versus Pepsi?
Well, I totally agree with that, but NASCAR has kind of set up that scenario where they're taking money, whether, it's the France family, it's going into their coffers, whether it's the France families who are involved in NASCAR or the France family that is involved in International Speedway Corp. They're basically playing both sides against the middle. And fundamentally, I have issues with it. I think it's a conflict of interest. And if I have a company the size of PepsiCo who's writing me a $14 million or whatever the amount is, check to Hendrick Motorsports, I'm going to be standing up for them in victory lane. I'm not going to want to support, you know, the competition when I have somebody who's supporting my race program. Jack Roush, who's one of the prominent owners in NASCAR, he saw that somebody in his parking lot at Livonia, Michigan, had driven a Toyota to work, and he paid the guy in yen that week. And so, I think the one thing, you know, Americans, they're going for that almighty dollar with all the sellouts that we have here. I give Jimmy and Jeff a lot of credit for staying loyal to their sponsor.
Yeah, but my question is, with all the stuff they slap on the cars and on the racing suits that these guys wear, who notices the presence or absence of one more logo?
I think they would notice the absence of one big check if Pepsi walked out tomorrow.
All right. I can't let you go, Lee, without an end-of-the-season prediction. When it's all over and this new system has all shaken down as it must, who wins the championship?
I say scratch four-time winner from Jeff Gordon's resume and put five-time. This guy has been there four times. He's won at 8 of the 10 remaining tracks. And I think if you're having to look at who's the guy to beat over, you know, the last 10 races, he would be my pick.
Lee Spencer writes about NASCAR for the Sporting News. She joined me on the line from the California Speedway in Fontana. Lee, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Anytime. Enjoyed it.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. When it came time to teach her 3-year-old son Jack to graduate from diapers, Carrie Heller decided to take advantage of Jack's devotion to baseball. Ms. Heller and her husband got a neighbor to impersonate Kansas City Royals first baseman Mike Sweeney and call Jack in order to encourage him to work on his delivery and to, quote, be a good little slugger. Over the next 2 days, an ersatz Jamie Walker, relief pitcher for the Detroit Tigers, and a pseudo Sammy Sosa called Jack to offer encouragement. Carrie Heller also rewards young Jack with candy and the occasional trip to Chuck E. Cheese, which, remarkably, is also where Mike Sweeney, Jamie Walker, and Sammy Sosa most like to eat.
Loosen up, don't get uptight. Party train is out of sight. Party, yeah, party.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, Muscle Beach, then and now. But first, following a smattering of games last weekend, today the college football season kicks off in earnest, as well as in South Bend, Philadelphia, Worcester, Annapolis, San Diego, and Columbus, among many, many other places. Joining me now for a preview of what is sure to be the greatest college football season ever is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, are you reclined and ready?
I have got my batteries in my remote. I'm ready for all-time game days every week.
Excellent.
And then some.
Excellent. Now, look, we have to agree at the outset that any mention hereafter of the term Bowl Championship Series or even the abbreviation BCS by you or even by me will result in immediate suspension from the show with possible penalties to follow, okay?
I'm good for that. It's too early in the year.
Okay, good. Some have suggested that the game between Florida State and Miami, which has been moved from Monday to Tuesday in order to accommodate Hurricane Francis, will in every way surpass the NFL's Monday night football matchups for the entire season. Do you agree?
It's going to be big. It's going to be big. This is as good of a rivalry as you have in college football. You have two national power programs, two in-state rivals. You always get to see a lot of future NFL players in that mm-hmm. in that game. And then to add to the drama this year, Miami has joined the ACC, which is Florida State's league. Mm-hmm. And the game now has even greater implications for a conference championship, which, as we know, in the formula that they use to determine who wins the championship, winning a conference title is imperative. So it's a high drama, high stakes, high rivalry game, but it also has a tremendous impact on what will happen at the end of the year.
Colorado will meet Colorado State tonight. Speaking of in-state rivalries, head coach Gary Barnett will be back on the sidelines again in Boulder after a three-month paid suspension. Now that a governing board at Colorado has been installed, is the program better equipped to avoid the scandal it faced this offseason after sexual assault allegations were leveled against its players and its recruits?
I think definitely it is, because this is going to be a zero-tolerance situation. Obviously, you can never control that something might happen out there, but there are strict policies and really a system in place to keep the recruits in line. Guys are only coming for one night instead of two. More emphasis at Colorado and hopefully around the country is going to be on actually meeting professors and meeting your coaches and getting a flavor for what the actual academic part of campus is about, maybe a little bit of student and student-athlete, and not just let's see how good of a time we can give the recruit and maybe he'll sign here. So I think Colorado, because of their failures in the past, have taken really step to the forefront on this. I think Gary Barnett, who survived with his job, has got to be quite happy to just get out in the football field tonight and coach football and not deal with all the other things that really almost cost him his job.
Nebraska will open the season without four players who the coach says have broken rules that he doesn't want to talk about. I understand their offense will be especially interesting to watch this year.
This is a whole new Nebraska. It's not your older brother, father's, or grandfather's Nebraska. After 30-plus years of running the wishbone, in comes Bill Callahan, former coach of the Oakland Raiders, to be the head coach, and he is going to gasp, throw the ball in Lincoln. Now, last year, Nebraska averaged 14 passes a game during the season. In the first quarter of the spring practice game, they threw 15 times. So this is a whole new situation at Nebraska. Change comes slowly in college football. This is going to be a big one in Nebraska. We'll see if this works as well as the old system.
Well, does a team like Nebraska, which has been so committed to the old system, does it succeed with a new system quickly enough to be a factor in one of the BCS bowls? Sorry. Oh, man. All right. Turn it off. That's enough. I learned my lesson, I promise. Let's talk a little about Texas. The Longhorns have a new Longhorn. There will be a ceremony at tonight's game to welcome Bevo XIV 14, for those not versed in Roman numerals. Bevo XIII retires with a record of 124-67-2. Will the new kid start strong?
Well, he looks a lot like the old one.
Wow, I'm shocked.
I think he will have a tremendous run right up until the Oklahoma game, when Bevo the 13th could never get him past Bob Stoops either.
I was surprised to learn, as I looked over the projections this week, that numbers of people feel that Rutgers may be a power in the Big East Conference. How did that happen?
Well, they have Greg Schiano, who was hired a couple years ago as the youngest coach in Division I football. He was a hotshot assistant at the University of Miami in Florida. He inherited an 0-11 program that was almost basically the laughing stock of the country. This guy is young. He's still in his late 30s, and he recruits and recruits and recruits, and they've slowly gotten better. And they're now certainly a team that can contend for the Big East title. And a couple years ago, if they won two games, this was going to be a good season. So at this point, he's got the ship turned around a little bit, and he continues to attract better and better players from New Jersey, which just great players from New Jersey stock rosters all over the country. There's no reason why they can't go to the state school.
Let's have some traditional first big week of the season talk. Which teams should we be looking for to win by, 55 or more points tonight and today?
It really is a tradition of September. Well, you got to like Oklahoma hosting Bowling Green. I would think certainly a shot that Oklahoma will try to score 70 on that one. Auburn and Louisiana Monroe has certainly got a chance. I think people that aren't fans or don't understand the economics of college football say, why would you even play these games if you're Louisiana Monroe or Bowling Green? Why would you go to Oklahoma? The answer is Oklahoma will pay Bowling Green $600,000 to come and play them and get massacred in most cases. So those 77-7 games are more to them than just the score.
It lends new meaning to the phrase, take one for the team, doesn't it?
You get a new weight room if you go play those BCS schools.
Oh.
I had to do it. I had to do it.
Dan Wetzel covers college football, among other things, for Yahoo Sports. He joined me on the line from his office in Royal Oak, Michigan. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
My eyes have seen the coming of another football year.
Cigarettes and beer. His eyes are both in focus on the color TV set, and the game goes on and on. Players running left and right. He hollers, "What a game!" Even though I'm standing here, he can't recall my name. He really is so worked up, he won't talk.
Millions of Americans who exercise enjoy the benefits of indoor gyms, but there are a lucky number of fitness enthusiasts who have for decades lifted, flexed, and dazzled in the California sun. Charlie Schroeder reports.
Under yet another sunny Southern California sky, about 500 people gather at Muscle Beach, the world-famous outdoor gym lying just off the boardwalk in Venice, California. They're here to watch the Venice Classic, Muscle Beach's annual amateur bodybuilding and figure contest, a competition open to anyone aged 13 and over with $40, a Speedo, and a healthy dose of chutzpah.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience. We're going to start right out with the men's masters, 40 to 49 years old. Let's bring them out on stage. They'll hit a few shots, file off, and then the top three will come back and do their closing presentation.
Joseph Davis, a personal trainer from Arizona, is just one of four family members who made the 10-hour drive to compete today.
Muscle Beach, that's a place you go to because it has the nostalgia. You go and compete at Muscle Beach, to me, you're competing in history. This is where the heart of the whole situation is. This is where it started. This is where, if you were a bodybuilder back in the earlier days, you came here. Schwarzenegger was back here. Frank Zane was over here. You know, people came here. This is where they wanted to be.
Heck, in 1965, Joe Gold opened the first Gold's Gym just around the corner. The modern fitness movement can be traced back to this very spot where Muscle Beach started, in Venice, California. Or can it?
A lot of people today actually don't even know that Muscle Beach was originally in Santa Monica. They think it's just Venice was always the original place.
That's Marla Matzer-Rose, author of Muscle Beach, subtitled Where the Best Bodies in the World Started a Fitness Revolution. She claims that Muscle Beach actually started a few miles up the boardwalk in Santa Monica, long before my governor started pumping iron in Venice.
Venice Beach started informally as an area where people started congregating and lifting weights, and it always was more of a weightlifting and bodybuilding venue than Muscle Beach, which started as more an acrobatic venue.
Acrobats? On the beach?
It started sort of informally in the probably mid-1930s. A number of the people that started it were students at Santa Monica High School, which is still right down near the beach. The kids would go down there to work out. Actually, there was an earthquake in the 30s, and they didn't have a gym for a time, and that was apparently part of the reason why kids started going down there.
It didn't take long for word to spread about the great feats and bodies on display at Muscle Beach. At a reception for the Santa Monica Historical Society's current exhibit of Muscle Beach photographs, several Muscle Beach alumni are in attendance. I'm talking with DeForest Mosen, Relna Brewer McRae, and Glenn Sunby, a few of the original Santa Monica Muscle Beach acrobats. These three are some of the many athletes who perform and share stunts with literally anyone who happened to wander by.
Wow. Apparently, you would have become an acrobat first time I seen you at the beach.
How would I become?
Bobby Yerkes came down one day. He says, "I want to play table tennis." So I ran the place then.
Yeah.
I said, "Forget the table tennis. I'm going up on a platform and work out." I said, "Come with me."
Yeah.
And he became one of the greatest flyers in the country.
Huh. He was a catcher.
Catcher. He was a catcher. Well,
let's just imagine we're back. It's 1938 or something like that. I go down to Muscle Beach. What would I see?
Well, on the platform, you'd see a few people working out, and you'd see fellas and swinging on the rings and high bar and the quad bars and the, a lot of pyramids. You see a lot of guys like Mo helping little kids learn how to do tricks. And
how many people would be in the audience? Could I get a seat?
In the summer, there'd be 10,000.
On weekends, there'd be thousands of people.
And it's easy to see why when you see these old photos. Abs of steel and chiseled jaws that would make a hardcore Atkins disciple green with envy. Did you eat well? Did you pay attention to, like, nutrition and
no,
stuff?
No, nobody thought about that in those days.
We ate what we could get.
Yeah, you only ate what you could get.
Isn't that the truth? We didn't take any drugs at all. We didn't even take aspirin, did we? Nothing. We felt so good that we'd go to bed and sleep good all night and get up and do the same thing the next day.
Mostly for fun. We were nobody was professionals. I mean, we all just did it for fun.
That's right.
Learning new tricks and meeting all our friends at the beach.
There's still major confusion to what caused Muscle Beach's demise. Some cite a scandal involving 5 weightlifters and 2 underage girls. Some say it just became too big, too fast. But at Venice Beach, you can still be surrounded by hundreds of half-naked bodies, painted bronze and glistening in the hot sun. Back at the Venice Classic, I'm speaking with Joanna Davis, the 16-year-old daughter of Joseph Davis, the personal trainer from Arizona. She's just finished competing in her first Venice Classic. What was going through your mind when you were out there?
To keep my stomach tight.
Did you have a hard time breathing? I can't. If I keep my stomach tight, I don't think I could breathe. I think I would fall over.
Yes, it was hard breathing.
Yeah, and pretty hot out there, too?
Yeah, I thought I was going to pass out.
The new Muscle Beach bears little resemblance to the acrobats of old, according to Bobby Yerkes, one of the greatest catchers in the history of acrobatics.
Muscle Beach here, to me, was like a circus. Venice is like the freak show. So I don't know. It just, it's not the same at all. It's not like the old Muscle Beach was, where I wish we were back again. I'd love to see it come back with all the acrobats together and competition, helping each other out and everything. It was really great days then.
For Only a Game, I'm Charlie Schroeder in Venice, California.
Okay, relax. Face the front and feet together. Give us a front lat spread. Hands, there you go. Terrific. Okay.
You're listening to Only a Game. Ruth Murphy, who hears Only a Game on WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, emailed this week to gently correct Charlie Pierce, who referred last week to Valparaiso, Indiana. Ms. Murphy says that Charlie meant Valparaiso and that Valparaiso is in Chile. Charlie took some heat from Carolyn Roosevelt, a WBUR listener as well. Charlie liked the version of our national anthem played during the Olympics. Ms. Roosevelt did not. She called it, quote, just awful. The third-place finish of the U.S. men's basketball team at the Games in Athens led WFSU listener Joe Ulf of Tallahassee, Florida, to suggest that in 2008, the U.S. should just send the team that wins the NCAA championship. Craig Kenworthy of Bozeman, Montana, has been thinking about the Olympics as well. He wrote to suggest an event merger, which would yield Greco-Roman sailing, in which the object would be to throw your opponent off his or her boat before it crossed the finish line. He'd also like to see beach volleyball move to adult pay-per-view. Louis Neisner, an adjunct professor in the R.H. Smith School of Business at the University of Maryland, emailed to express his delight that Charlie had mentioned Brianna Scurry in our discussion of the victorious U.S. women's soccer team last week. I can't understand why she was not interviewed like all the other stars were, and why the press has not given her performance more prominence in their reporting, he wrote. George Miller, a WBUR listener, wrote to express his support of gold medal-winning gymnast Paul Hamm and concluded his email by remarking that Hamm and Yang Tae-young, whose performance was improperly scored, quote, are learning a painful lesson about the inexorable ways of the world. Old men make mistakes and young men pay the price. Finally, a great many people contacted us to ask about the song Poisoning Pigeons in the Park, with which we concluded my conversation with Charlie Pierce last week. The composer is Tom Lehrer, and the song was performed by Yale University's Mixed Company on a compact disc entitled A Cappella Party. You can send your questions, corrections, or commendations to us via our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Our regular address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
When they see us coming, the birdies all try and hide.
But they still go for peanuts when coated with cyanide.
The sun shining bright.
Everything seems all right when we're poisoning pigeons in the park. Tra-la.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Joe Namath, then and now. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce on the line from New York to talk about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Please get me back to sports in a hurry.
Yeah, New York, U.S. Open tennis, Yankees hanging on to the AL East lead. Anything else happening down there?
Republicans leaving town.
All right, anyway, this week, 14 months after Kobe Bryant was charged with felonious sexual assault, the case against him was dropped. Was that inevitable?
I think it's been inevitable for 4 or 5 months ever since it became quite plain that his lawyers were doing a much better job demolishing the prosecution's case than the prosecution was doing building it. This is an event that does not redound to anyone's credit, least of all the American justice system. But it does, in our weird kind of postmodern world, present the question of what does TV news do when a big trial doesn't become a big trial.
On Thursday, Romania's Olympic medalists reaped considerable financial rewards, Charlie. The government paid out over $66,000 for each gold medal, $53,000 for the silver, and $40,000 for the bronze. Not too bad for a country in which the average monthly salary is $180.
Well, that's great, because that means you can live in, I'm doing the math now, you can live in Romania for what, 400 years or something if you're a gold medalist?
Another big Olympic winner was NBC, whose primetime Olympic coverage destroyed the network competition. There's got to be an executive at NBC somewhere who's currently thinking, how do we do this all year round?
Please don't give us the Olympics all year round. But I think it's an interesting example of how sports is all now televised entertainment, because the shows that are getting the ratings are the shows that were covering events that happened 7 or 8 or 9 hours earlier. And yet the presentation of them as television entertainment was a ratings winner. We are sliding down the slippery slope towards where we don't even need live events at all.
Speaking of sports and television, sort of sports anyway, next fall, Texas Tech basketball coach Bob Knight may be stepping into the TV spotlight via proxy. How do you like the idea of a CBS sitcom based on Knight's madcap real-life adventures?
Well, I can't figure out if it's going to be modeled more on All in the Family, except that this Archie character will throw his chair across the living room, or on F Troop, where he will personally run out and knock the guard tower over.
There you go. The University of Nebraska football team will have to begin the season without center Richie Incognito, who has violated team policy as well as various other statutes having to do with the state. Wouldn't you think somebody named Incognito would be especially careful in this regard?
Well, it's unspecified. Can we estimate that perhaps he'd be found guilty of identity theft? And let me ask you another question. If somebody from Incognito shows up for practice anyway, will anyone know?
Oh, that's an excellent question. I think he's got a case. Charlie, the NFL season kicks off on Thursday with the Patriots playing the Colts. Is this the best way for the league to go with Peyton Manning trembling at the outset?
Well, it's a measure, of course, of how far the New England Patriots have come from the clown college days, that they are the league kickoff on Thursday night. But, I mean, it's very interesting. This is exactly the same thing that used to happen to Peyton Manning in college. He used to have to play Florida the second or third game of the year. This is the biggest test he has. And given the contract they signed him to and the fact that that contract may, in fact, prevent them from signing Edgerrin James and Marvin Harrison down the line, it's a big night for Peyton.
Perhaps the biggest baseball story of the week is that the Yankees have been in a tailspin. New York has frittered away most of what used to be a double-digit lead in the American League East. And I guess Joe Torre and his guys would be worried if it was anybody but the Red Sox in second place.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because this happens to the Yankees periodically and has over the last 4 or 5 years. In 2000, I believe it was, They went in an awful tailspin. I mean, they were terrible. They were sub-Tampa Bay in the month of September and managed to win the World Championship anyway. But right now, the biggest problem the Yankees have is that their pitching is starting to fall apart, and it doesn't look like it's going to be redeemable before the end of the year. And they're now going to go back to trying to club people to death, which puts them, at least on paper, disadvantaged against the Red Sox, who at least have two and possibly three now that Derek Lowe's pitching better, three really good quality Major League starting pitchers who are healthy.
It hasn't helped the Mariners very much, Charlie, but Ichiro Suzuki has been hitting nearly 500 since the All-Star break. He's only about 40 hits shy of George Sisler's Major League record for most hits in a season, which is an incredible 257 hits. Do we know when he gets to be a free agent?
No, we don't, Bill, but there are 27 general managers in baseball who have the date on the calendar marked in red neon. It's very embarrassing. They have their day planners closed, but you can still see the flashes. He's going after George Sisler's record for hits in a season, which is one of those records that has stood for a zillion years. And one of those records, like Hack Wilson's 190 RBIs, that didn't look like anybody was ever going to get after it.
Just two short years ago, the Hornets, late of Charlotte, convinced the National Basketball Association that the team would draw when it moved to New Orleans. It hasn't done so. Season ticket holders are not renewing their packages. Will razzle-dazzle new ticket packages help at all?
Boy, I'll tell you one thing. There are con men, and there are con men, and then there are the people who own what used to be the Charlotte Hornets. It is such a tough sell in New Orleans for the entertainment dollar. And a franchise that's coming in a little bit dinged up with an owner that not a lot of people trust is going to be an even harder sell than that. And if I were the people who are positing the notion that the Montreal Expos, for example, should move to Las Vegas, I would watch what's happening in New Orleans very carefully. Because when you compete to the entertainment dollar with one of the two cities in this country that invented the entertainment dollar, you've got a long road to hoe.
At Tuesday's U.S. Open, Serena Williams held up play before her second-round victory so that somebody could fetch her earrings from the locker room. I wonder if there would have been another delay if Ms. Williams had been presented with the wrong earrings.
Well, if you noted the wire service photo, she was also dressed up like some weird combination of Margaret Smith Court and Ellie Mae Clampett. The denim and the knee-high tennis shoes are not going to catch on, I predict this.
Finally, Charlie, penitentiary officials in McAlester, Oklahoma, found nearly 2 pounds of marijuana inside a basketball at the state's Talawanda Heights minimum security facility. Is there any truth to the rumor that it was an old ABA ball from the 70s?
I'll tell you one thing. They may have finally found a ball that some people on our Olympic team can shoot.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Late in his new book about Joe Namath, Mark Kriegel writes of his subject, quote, "He was never one of the guys." That was, as Kriegel discovered, the quarterback's blessing and his curse. Mark Kriegel joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau to discuss Namath, a biography. Mark, welcome to Only a Game.
How are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you. The team might as well have been called Joe Namath and the Jets, because Namath was so obviously the star. But what did he sacrifice precisely by not being one of the guys?
I think he was obligated to be not one of the guys. The Jets had a two-tier system. There was Namath, and then there was everyone else. as time went on, it had its own peculiar burdens for him. There's something about Joe Namath that makes people want him to remain this kid who made the guarantee. In a lot of ways, he's obligated to play that role. It's become something of a vocation for him.
It's kind of like being consigned to be Peter Pan.
Yes, it's like having to dwell in some sort of post-adolescent state. Mm. It's not just fans, it's people with otherwise very astute judgment. For instance, Rune Arledge, the impresario behind Monday Night Football, hires Joe for the broadcast booth in 1985. And at the time, the telecast is in a good bit of trouble. Howard Cosell has left. The ratings are plummeting. And Rune Arledge sees the broadcast salvation in Broadway Joe. The problem was Joe Namath was then a middle-aged man, an expectant father. He was no longer Broadway Joe, but somehow even people as astute as Arledge thought he could somehow instantly morph back into the kid he had been at 22, 23, 24.
Anybody who knows anything about Joe Namath knows that he suffered multiple gruesome injuries as a pro, especially to his knees. But I learned from your book that at least one of Namath's knees was very severely damaged before he even played his first down as a pro in 1965. Were the Jets aware of the risk that they were taking when they drafted him?
Sports medicine was not what it is today. Namath was drafted because of his enormous physical potential. And more than that, because of what was then his abundant charisma. Sonny Werblin, who was then the boss of the Jets, his background had been in MCA, as the boss of MCA Television, which was really the most powerful concern in American entertainment. MCA determined a lot of what Americans saw on primetime. More than Namath's physical state, Werblin was concerned with procuring the services of a leading man. He was going to do for Sunday's programming, what he had already done for primetime. And he was charmed by Namath's grin, his demeanor, and as he has famously said, his ability to light up the room. From the beginning, Werblin was talking about Namath as a potential star for Universal, as he compared him to Dean Martin, to Sinatra. and these were not comparisons that owners were making about ballplayers back in 1965. But Namath is the first ball player seen as a television property.
Just to give our listeners some idea of what Joe Namath would go through to prepare for a game, I'd like you to read from the middle of page 267 of your biography.
This is the Super Bowl, which in fact was not all that different from how he was prepared for most other games. Five syringes had been prepared. The first contained Novocaine injected below the left kneecap. The second, shot through the same needle, contained 25 milligrams of prednisone, a cortisone compound to relieve pain and inflammation in the left tendon. Then Nicholas drained off a couple of ounces of fluid from the right knee. Next, returning to the left, he shot the back of the knee with Novocaine, followed by another 25 milligrams of prednisone to relieve inflammation in the bursal sac. Finally, the doctor offered a painkilling injection for his right thumb. This, Namath declined. He would need all his touch for the game. Nicholas sent him away with a bottle of red pills, just in case the left knee acted up again.
Now, beyond all of the medication that you describe in that paragraph, Namath was also medicating himself with alcohol. To what extent did that lead, you think, to his condition later in life, where he acknowledged a year or so ago himself that he was an alcoholic?
I don't think that there's any doubt that his alcoholism is related to his analgesic use or use of alcohol for analgesic purposes. And that was an accepted way to do it. In fact, as Larry Grantham, one of his teammates, told me, it was the most acceptable of all analgesics. And I think what happens to Namath over time is that he loses the ability to distinguish between physical and emotional pain. And when he finds himself in some searing state of hurt when his marriage breaks up. He had been sober for most of the marriage, but when this breaks up and he finds himself in this pain again, he medicates himself as he had. If you were to ask most people what the significant event in Joe Namath's life was, they would probably tell you the guarantee in the Super Bowl. I think if you were to ask Joe Namath, he would tell you it's the breakup of his parents' marriage and his father leaving when he was a 12-year-old kid in seventh grade. And when his own marriage breaks up, he falls into a state of pain, of depression.
Your explanation, Mark, for why Joe Namath played as long as he did under the circumstances that he had to endure is that he just loved football beyond reason. After the knee replacements, the arthritis, the physical problems beyond those that he suffered from, not to mention the alcoholism, has Joe Namath had second thoughts?
No, I don't think so. I think that he wanted to hang on as long as he could. You know, it was every training camp, it seems, there was some sort of drama about Namath. Would he play? Would he retire? And usually he's the one voicing these doubts. I don't know how much longer I can go on. But it becomes very clear as the Jets got closer to the season. He wanted to play very, very badly. He loved the game. He had a wonderful sense of the game. Playing hurt was better than not playing.
Mark, you make a terrific case in your book that Joe Namath was one of a kind, but to what extent was his experience as a quarterback, as a pro football veteran, typical of the pro football quarterback's experience?
They all wind up physically damaged. If you go to Canton and you see these guys every summer for induction ceremonies, you'll see what kind of physical toll this game takes. Namath's circumstances were a little different because he hurt his knee his senior year at Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
From the time he comes up, he is basically defenseless. He can't slip a punch. He can't really get out of harm's way. And I think that makes it different, even from the typical NFL quarterback. George Sauer told me, and Sauer was really a wonderful split end on the Jets championship team, that Namath would call extra long pass routes, knowing that they would take a good long time to develop and knowing that he would get clobbered, but still called them anyway. That tells you something about Namath's ability to take a hit and also his temperament as a gambler. He always wanted to push it.
Did working on this book cause you to change the way you think about pro football?
No, it didn't change the way I thought about pro football. It did change the way I thought about Namath. And it was when I started this, I went to his longtime agent and representative, Jimmy Walsh, who they've been partnered up almost since their days at Alabama. And he made it clear that the Joe's cooperation would have to be the result of some sort of financial arrangement. I couldn't do that. I didn't think that I could write this book and be in business with Namath, especially since so much of it was about the commerce of being Namath.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't think it would make for good journalism. So we never got together. But I will say that almost 500 pages into this thing, I am pretty well acquainted with his frailties and his faults. And I will say that I do have more affection and respect for him now than I did when I was a kid and he was a poster over my wall. He's something more real to me now. He's more real to me now than ball players whom I covered and I was in the same locker room with every day.
Mark Kriegel is the author of Namath, a Biography, published by Viking. He spoke to me from NPR's New York Bureau. Mark, thank you very much for joining me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
New York on Sunday. Big city taking a nap. Slow down, it's Sunday. Life's a ball, let it fall right in your lap. If you've got troubles, just take them out for a walk. They'll burst like bubbles in the fun of a Sunday in New York.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Mark Kriegel's biography of Joe Namath, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Yahoo Sports college football guy Dan Wetzel, who thinks Texas Longhorn Bevo the 14th has got it made.
If you're in the animal kingdom, being a college mascot is a pretty good deal.
Well, I suppose so, but I wonder if the banana slug, the power gull, and the mad monk of St. Joseph's feel the same way. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
By Monday morning, your folks agreed it was fate. As day comes dawning, if you can't pick the spot or set the date, you met on Sunday, New York on Sunday, so make it Sunday in New York.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.